Good evening. If you'll be opening up to Genesis chapter 25, we'll start there and then make our way to Hebrews 2, which will be the main text for us to study. I appreciate Evan leading that last song. That will be a nice tie-in to some of the things that we're going to talk about this evening. Genesis 25 contains within a fairly well-known story, interaction between Jacob and Esau, which reveals for us the very messy way that God's covenant plan gets worked out because he's dealing with human beings who are not always the nicest, wisest people. And so this is one such example. So let's pick up the reading in verse 27. So when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. When Jacob had cooked a stew, Esau came in from the field and was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please, let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I'm famished." Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "Well, first, sell me your birthright." Esau said, "Behold, I'm about to die, so what of you is this birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "First swear to me." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. So we have this scenario. You've got two brothers who are depicted as quite different. Esau is the skilled hunter. Jacob is more kind of the way it's describing of him. He's more of a refined who lives in his tents and does things like that. So they're kind of opposite individuals, and because of that, they get different love from their parents. So Esau's gone out, and he's hunted all day, or for a couple of days, and he's come back very hungry, which I assume is like when I've come back from the grocery store. I assume it's the same thing. So he's very hungry. He sees Jacob has some stew, so they really like some of that. Now, we know from previous descriptions in Genesis that Jacob has been looking for a way to scheme. And this is sort of speaks of his character, wanting to get that birthright or that blessing for himself. So he sees an opportunity, tells Esau, "I'll give you some food, but you've got to sell me your birthright. I've got to receive the blessing as the firstborn son." And Esau's response in verse 32 is what's key for our lesson tonight. His response is, "I'm going to die, so I don't really care about the birthright. So give me the food." That he acts out of a fear of death and thereby gives up, and the writer will say at the end, despised his birthright, treated it as nothing because for him, his fear of death outweighed it. This idea of a fear of death is one of the most, if not the most, powerful motivations that human beings experience. The way it governs our actions and dictates moral choices out of a fear that we might die. Now, in typical Christian formula, we put the order like this, and there's biblical merit for that, don't misunderstand, but that human beings sin, and therefore human beings die. Right? And there is truth to that. The Hebrew writer in Hebrews 2 will flip the equation and will say, human beings die, and therefore human beings sin, because we are governed and motivated by this fear. And so this evening, I want to look at the Hebrew writer in Hebrews 2, as he describes this fear of death that he says enslaves us, but then perhaps more importantly for us, how do we break ourselves from that? How do we release ourselves from that bond? So let's go over to Hebrews 2 together, and we'll begin reading in verse 5. He begins, "For he did not subject to angels the world to come, concerning which we are speaking." So God did not subject the world to angels. "But one is testified, saying somewhere, 'What is man that you remember him? Or the son of man that you are concerned about him? You have made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, and have appointed him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him. But now we do not see all things yet subjected to him.'" So the author begins describing this crown or this reign over creation. And he does so, this comes back in from chapter 1, this comparison between Jesus and angels. And the author is wanting to say Jesus is high above the angels, and he uses as an example of that, look, the angels weren't given, their dominion over the earth, right? That's gone somewhere else. And to make this point, he goes to Psalm 8. Now, Psalm 8 originally was used to speak about the role of human beings over nature, that human beings are the image of God who have been given the task to rule and exercise dominion over creation, going back to Genesis 1 and 2, and that's their position. Now, we might already understand some trouble with that, because you're telling us human beings are high above over the creation and are have dominion over it, and yet we are so small and insignificant. Do we really exercise dominion over a creation that has hurricanes and tornadoes and droughts and cancer? Do we really have exercised dominion over the world? But, the author says, and he kind of leaves it with us with some anticipation, that all things are being subjected, and he says in verse 8, but we don't quite see that. But then he says in verse 9, but we do see him who was made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. So the author has said, look, human beings have been given dominion over the earth. You and I don't see that, right? We see all of the problems and the sufferings that human beings experience from the earth and feel helpless and out of control. But he says, there is a man who reigns over all of the creation. It's Jesus of Nazareth. That this promise or this hope, this psalm must be read Christologically. It must be read with Jesus as the true fulfillment over it. And he says, there has been nothing in creation that is not subjected to him. That his rule is universal, it is supreme, and it is unchallenged. So this will then take us as we develop his thought in Hebrews 2. If he is the one who reigns, if it's Jesus who exercises dominion, if it's Jesus who fulfills this vision of Psalm 8, then that must inform the way you and I think about exercising our own victory, particularly as we are confronted by this concept or issue of death. So let's continue. It says, for it was fitting for him for whom all things, and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all from one Father, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will proclaim your name to my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children whom God has given me. Let's pause it there. So the author has addressed this immediate objection to. It's basically the continuation of the, how do you say human beings have dominion over the earth when it seems like frequently the earth has dominion over us? Same kind of thing with the Christian claim that Jesus rules over the creation, right? And that all things are subjected to him, because there are still holocausts and genocides and greed and rape and all number of evils that still exist in the world. And so he is addressing this issue with his audience too. How can we still claim that it's Jesus who rules over the earth? And so he has to unpack then, how is it that the victory has been won in Jesus and then continues to be won in the people that he calls brethren? And he makes this argument by focusing on the humanity of Jesus. He wants to focus on Jesus as the human being, which hopefully stresses for us why the incarnation is not just one among many things that Christians believe. That it is fundamental both to how we think about God, but then also how we think about ourselves and our place in the world, that we draw these lessons and this image from the humanity of Christ. So the Son is said to have become a human being so that he may taste death for all. He has to become like us so that he will suffer like us. And that's said to be fitting, because he is the one through whom all things have come, and all things are for him. So it's tied in to God as creator. God has created all of these things. All things have been made through Jesus, and therefore Jesus bears ownership of those things. And because he bears ownership, he feels responsibility and a compelled to come to its rescue. So that he can't just create and then say, well, I'm done with it, as if he's some sort of deist God who winds the clock and lets it roll. He has created and therefore feels compelled to come to its deliverance. And so the author says in verse 10 that it was fitting for him to perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings, kind of eliminating that middle part that we just talked about. That it was fitting for Jesus to become a human being and to suffer death. Your translation, as the New American Standard does, has there in verse 10 that he is the author of our salvation. Several commentators looked and have argued that that author is perhaps not the best way, though it still, I think, works either way. If it's author and he's the starting point of our salvation, some have said that ought to be translated something more like champion. And I think that fits better contextually with where he's going to go in this second half of chapter 2 that we'll look at. He is our champion. And you get a sense of this ancient idea of a champion with David and Goliath, right? Goliath goes out into the field and he says, look, I will represent the Philistines. You send somebody from your side. It'll be one-to-one combat and winner take all. That's the idea of a champion. So that Jesus is seen as the champion, the one who goes out as the one to do battle for us. And it ties into various Greek stories that would have circled in the world, particularly maybe most directly of Hercules, who's said to have stormed into the gates of Hades and done battle with Cerberus and the three-headed dog that guarded the gates, and that he emerged victorious. But now the author's saying, look, all of those stories mean nothing. It's Jesus who is the champion who has gone to fight. But how is it that he's gone to fight? What was the fitting role of combat? It was his suffering and his willingness to die that proved his victory. And these things are fitting for him, much in the same way that Paul will argue it was fitting in Philippians 2, that this is not an aberration of God, as if God acts one way the whole rest of the time, but did this really strange thing once in 30 AD to be crucified. He says it's fitting because this speaks of the continuing, ongoing character of God, the one who will stoop down to the rescue of his creation, so that what Jesus did on the cross is completely consistent with the character of God and reveals that to us. And so with this, he says in verse 11, that because he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all of one Father, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren. The incarnation, then here the Son taking on flesh, means he now views us as brothers and sisters. That there's a kinship relationship between us and the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, through whom all things were created. This, again, is why this notion of the incarnation of Jesus becomes so important for us. Not just as a theological doctrine to speculate about, but of recognizing who we are and who is on our side and why it's fitting for him to be on our side. So it reveals, because of the way in which Jesus fought this battle and the way that he views us now as his brethren and not ashamed to call us his brethren as if he has to hide his face and pretend like he doesn't know us most of the time. He says, no, these are mine. They are my family. I'm not ashamed of these people. One author, he phrased it like this, the way we might view those who are suffering or in agony somewhere or caught up in sin. And we say, there but for the grace of God go I. Right? They're in a really bad spot and I'm really glad I'm not there. The author flipped it and said that Jesus would say something like, there because of the grace of God go I. That he enters into that situation, that solidarity with his creation and to become one of us. So Jesus is then presented as the faithful one. Hebrews 2, picking up in verse 14. Therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and might free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. For assuredly, he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendants of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in all things, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. So Jesus shares in everything of his creation, except sin, including the sting of death, that he is identified completely with those that he created, so that, the author says, he can disarm the devil, that he can remove the devil's favorite weapon, death. This is somewhat, if you remember the first reading this morning from Colossians 2, where Paul in Colossians talks about Jesus through the crucifixion disarming the principalities and powers and making them a spectacle. Same sort of idea, winning his victory over the evil forces. John Chrysostom, an early Christian writer and preacher, said that that Jesus used the devil's favorite tool against him, right? Using death to disarm Satan. Now we'll talk about this in a few moments, what exactly this would mean and how we think about Jesus freeing us from the fear of death. But suffice it to say for now, this ultimately centers on the idea of Jesus' faithfulness, that there is a consistency to the life of Jesus in which at no point does he deviate from the will of God, including in the Garden of Gethsemane facing his own death, right? In which he has the prayer before God, if there's some other way we can go, let's do it, but if not, I'm faithful to you and won't let death dictate the actions. So he blazed a path of action that does not succumb to the fear that the Hebrew writer says enslaves all of us. Now, by doing this, by being faithful, by being our champion, by going and winning the victory through his sufferings, says he's freed us from our enslavement. Hebrews will use consistently throughout an Exodus theme. We have here our enslavement to the fear of death. The ultimate tyrant is ruling over us. But God comes to our rescue to free us from that. He then sort of moves into the language of wilderness wanderings that comes up the next couple of chapters, ultimately leading in Hebrews 12 to receiving an unshakable kingdom. So it plays right into God doing what God does, coming to the rescue of his enslaved people, whether it be Pharaoh a few millennia before, or whether it be Hebrew Christians in the first century, or whether it be Texans in the 21st century. And so he has freed us from this. And because of that, he goes in verse 17. I keep saying because of that, but I hope it's because the Hebrew writer keeps saying because of that. Because he has done this, therefore, because he's been made like his brethren in all things, he is now able to become the merciful and faithful high priest. What's startling about that is when you compare this concept to the high priest in the Old Testament, because so much of the high priest being able to function is him being withdrawn. Because he couldn't be out and about amongst all of the sin and the defilement and around everything, lest he not be able to function. The Hebrew writer says it's exactly because Jesus went out and went into the dirt with everyone else that he can be the high priest. Because he went right into the struggle and the suffering, he now functions as the one who can intercede before us and can come to those who find themselves tempted, can come to their aid because he knows what that's like. That's not foreign to his experience. So the author has painted a very powerful and vivid picture of what it means for Jesus to be victorious and because of that victory, be the high priest. Let's talk a little bit about this idea of the fear of death and what exactly that might mean or look like. Some of you may know exactly what that is like, because you may feel that very near and pressing to you. You may feel the fear of death bearing very strongly down upon you, either because you might think that your death is coming near, or a loved one is being ravaged by disease or whatever suffering might be in their life, and you might sense that very deeply, what that's like to have death pressing on us. Now, I am a young man, and so I can't really tell you that I have felt that fear very much, as if I felt like my death was really pressing, except when my children were born. Both theirs and mine became a very real concern. I feared for them because they're so small, right, and helpless, and so many things could happen to them, and would I be able to prevent all of those things, right? Would I be able to protect them from all of the things that might harm them? And then it made me then think of my own death, because as you, those of you that have to drive on interstates in the morning know, not always the safest place to be, and there's 2-ton, you know, hunks of metal flying by me, and what if something was to happen to me, right? And what would happen to my children? You know, what would they think of their dad? Would, you know, they have to undergo great suffering the rest of their life thinking about growing up without a father, and all these sorts of fears and anxieties come with it. And so we may experience that way or by our own mortality or whatever form it takes. But here's where it becomes where the struggle manifests itself. And various studies have shown this to be the case, but I think anecdotally we probably know this is the case, that the things that give us the greatest joy in life also create in us the greatest fear. My children as an example, right? What greater joy is there than to hold your newborn child in your arms? But what greater fear comes with, how am I going to take care of and protect this new life? Or we think about it when we open ourselves up to someone else to say, I love you. Right? What greater experience is there to say, I love you, and have somebody reciprocate that back and say, I love you too. But what pain is there that is greater than, I love you, and the love does not come back? Or what about when we begin to spend time with our grandparents or our parents, and we think the time may be coming to a close? And while we greatly enjoy getting to spend time with them, we're also aware of what has to come at some point. And so, or even, you know, we get comfortable in our positions in life and we think, job's going well, church is going well, things are good, but do those things come to an end? And so what we do when we face this fear too often is say, the vulnerability is too much, right? I'm opening myself up for too much pain and too much heartache, and that fear then causes us to pull back and say, maybe I'm not going to give my love to others because if I don't get it back, it will hurt too much. Maybe I can't become too attached to the people in my life because the fear of loss is too much. That if I become too comfortable in my life, if I begin to enjoy my life too much, or be happy with the station I'm in life, that's when it will end. And so fear causes us to pull back because love makes us vulnerable. And the fear of death overcomes the love that would open us up and do all sorts of thriving and beneficial relationships. So either we withdraw from it or we begin to attempt to prevent death by any means possible. Right, so you can think of Jesus there in the garden. If the fear of death had overcome him, what would his next course of action been to prevent it? And what would that have looked like for the plan of God? We also, now that, right, you may say, Jared, I don't have kids, or I don't really think about death very much, or I'm not really concerned about it. So maybe. But what about the fear of lack? Right, we might not think very much about our own mortality. No show of hands, but how many of you today experienced a great struggle just being here? Your body hurts. You've been working all week, wrestling with the kids, trying to get here, trying to get everybody in the place, and you're exhausted, and you're worn out, and you're beaten down, and you know that there's just not enough time to do everything. That speaks to that sort of deflation and exhaustion is a reminder of our mortality, that we are creatures, that we're flesh and blood, and that flesh and blood runs out, and the clock is ticking, and there's just not enough time and just not enough energy to do all of the things that need to get done. Some call this the sense of lack that we have to suffer through, this anxious feeling that it creates. So we spend our time cataloging all the things that we lack. Big one, probably we don't have enough time, don't have enough sleep, we don't have enough money in the bank account, we don't have enough ability to spend time with family like we would want to, we don't have enough food on the table, we don't have enough safety, or we don't have enough health care. And this is heightened even worse when we realize I don't have enough of these things, but I look out at other people, they seem to have enough of those things, and why is it that I don't? Right? Is there something wrong with me? Why I have to suffer through this lack, but everybody else seems to be so good? And so we suffer from not having money to pay the bills. We suffer from a low self-esteem and comparing ourselves with others. Now again, I'll give you a window into my suffering of this sense of lack. And it comes with the students that come into my classroom. Because I hear the horror stories of what their life is like at home. Of the abuse that they have to undergo, of the poverty that they have to endure, the neglect that they suffer through. And the sense of lack that I experience is, how am I going to do enough for these people before me? How can I possibly serve all of them the way that they need to be served and have any ounce of me left to drag home and give love to my family? And it sometimes is very crushing and heartbreaking to see that before me, that there's a fear of never being able to do enough. Again, because we are mortal. And so suffering through the sense of lack, one author, he brought up three temptations that it creates. There's the temptation for relevance, wanting ourselves to be in the mix, right? Wanting us to make some sort of difference. A temptation to be spectacular, to win fame and acclaim and at least have what I do mean something to someone, for them to recognize and praise me for the things that I do, or a temptation to be powerful so that we can make things happen. And all of these things we hope will overcome that fear of lack. That if I could just become more well-known, I wouldn't feel like my life is meaningless. If I could just get more power in my hands, I could force things to get done and I would be able to accomplish more before my end comes. And so we struggle for attention and praise from others. Right? We want them to recognize us. We want them to see and praise the things that we do. We want to be famous and well-known, or we want to compete with others in the sense of lack, and so we become materialistic. We judge the worth of our life on the things that we have. Here's the struggle. Just like the fear of the end can prevent us from loving, so this competition prevents us from loving others. How can I really get down on my knees and wash somebody's feet if all I'm really wanting is people just to pay attention to me? I don't really care about this other person in front of me. I'm not really looking to serve them. I'm looking out for me. Somebody notice the things that I do. And it's impossible to be a true servant if what we want is power and prestige. And so this fear of lack, this fear of the end, this fear of death, enslaves us for our entire life, the Hebrew writer. These people's entire lives enslaved to that. And it prevents them from completing the will of God. So that the devil's tool to drive us to sin at its root is our fear of death and our own mortality. So how is this defeated? 1 John 4 and verse 18, the writer there says that perfect love casts out all fear. That it's love that is the antidote. That if we're going to break the chains of our enslavement, it comes through love. And it comes through a recognition and acceptance of the love Jesus has for us as it's embodied and seen in the incarnation. Right? His not being ashamed to call us brothers and sisters, to say, these are mine. Which is why worship and prayer are so fundamental to this struggle. Because when you and I pray, we acknowledge that it is to God that I must go to for my strength and my help. Right? It keeps things in proper perspective. And it allows us to see, right, when we come to God in gratitude for the things that we have, and we thank God for the laundry list of things that He has blessed us with, we begin to recognize that our lives are a gift from Him. Right? The things that we have are an act of grace from God rather than just simple human striving. Not just about what I can accomplish, but what God has graciously given to me. And worship serves the same function, right? It serves the same way. It reminds us when we sing these songs and we take this cup that it is God that has graciously acted towards us. So it's in Christ that we learn how much God loves us. And it's in Christ, not in ourselves, that we find out how much we have and that what we have is enough. And so it's gratitude. That when we grasp the perfect love of God, We don't have to act out of fear any longer, but we can act out of love. And so perhaps the simplest way to engage in this defeat of the devil is to spend time in the morning when we get up before we can let the concerns pile up and all of that anxiety take hold of us, to think, what are the things that I'm thankful for? What are the signs of God's love that I have that I can be thankful for and recognize as gracious? And that will hopefully embolden us to act out of love. And finally, Jesus' identification with us breaks new ground. Right? It breaks a path of action before us that we can follow. Because this whole section in Hebrews 2 is about His faithfulness through His suffering, or the fear that might have taken hold of somebody else, that He remained faithful to God in that whole process. And so He shows for us a path forward where He can come to us in our temptations and say, no, here is the way you should be going. And that for Jesus is not armchair quarterbacking. For Him to say, well, you know, this might be a good idea, or dream up some scenario. It's because He knows what it's like that He can say, this is what faithfulness to God looks like. And it looks like Jesus. And so rather than temptation and the fear of death dictating actions, the love of Jesus does. N.T. Wright said this, that I thought was powerful. He said, there is nothing we face today or tomorrow or the next day in which Jesus cannot sympathize, which He cannot help, and from which He rescues us, and through which He cannot forge a way to God's new world. Nothing you and I will face, there's not something from Jesus that will help us show the right way to go, and that by following His obedience leads to our own victory. Or Stanley Hauerwas said this, that to follow Jesus is to undergo a training that refuses to let death, even the death at the hands of an enemy, determine the shape of our living. Death doesn't get to tell us how to act. The love of Jesus tells us how to act. So how do we participate in God's transformation of the world? Right? How do we make the kingdom on earth as it is in heaven? By refusing to act out of fear, but instead acting out of love. And Jesus, as our champion, shows us that victory is possible that way, that it is realistic to live that way because He did. So the Hebrew writer reveals that what often enslaves us is not an abstract thing we might call sin, that what enslaves us is the fear of death, that what motivates us to forsake the will of God, to become selfish, to become idolatrous, to become violent, is the fear of our own mortality. But Jesus, as the ruler of the world, says that here is the path of victory, and that it is fitting to follow in His footsteps, not in avoiding death at all costs, but by remaining faithfully obedient to God. It was fitting for Jesus to do that, and is therefore fitting for the people who bear His name to do that. And so this evening, the call is from this one who rules over the creation, that there's nothing that is not subject to Him. And that includes my life, and that includes your life. That we are already subject to His rule. He already reigns over us. The call now is, will we have faith? Will we pledge our allegiance to Him and say, I'll follow You wherever You take me? And it's to Him that you're invited to respond to now as we stand and sing.